Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Alice LaPlante's new novel, Turn of Mind, is a whodunit with a twist. The suspect suffers from Alzheimer's disease. She cannot remember if she killed her best friend. It's an intriguing premise, one that strikes close to home for the author. LaPlante's own mother suffers from Alzheimer's disease. She drew upon her firsthand experiences to craft the character of Dr. Jennifer White. Readers are given a moving portrait of a deteriorating mind. Do join us. Call us with your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Alice, good morning to you.
Good morning. Delighted to be here.
I'm so glad you've written this novel because it is, even though fictional, it gives us an insight to the confusion that the Alzheimer's patient feels and the sense of not knowing from minute to minute where she is, what she just did, or what she should be doing. You came upon this how?
Well, as you said, my mother has Alzheimer's, and it's something our family has been dealing with for nearly a decade now, the fallout from that. I'd like to stress that there's nothing autobiographical about the novel in terms of my mother's character. I just took my observations and put them into fiction.
How long ago did your mother begin to show signs of Alzheimer's?
Probably about a decade ago.
A decade ago. And what made you first aware of the fact that she seemed to be acting differently, perhaps?
You know, it creeps up, as anyone who has a loved one with Alzheimer's knows. And I actually can't put my finger on a specific time or place. We understood that we were at ground zero because her mother had Alzheimer's. Her sister had died of it. There was Alzheimer's throughout the family. Me and my siblings joke in a very black way about what's ahead for us. So it wasn't a surprise when we started seeing signs.
Now, when we meet the fictional character in your book, Dr. Jennifer White, she already has dementia. What was she like before the dementia set in?
As I see the character, she's extremely strong-willed, highly intelligent. She's an orthopedic surgeon, quite a good one. Probably I'm one of the first females in her field, used to plowing ahead through adversary. She's got an unconventional view of life and relationships. She's a very interesting woman and very much used to being in control and capable of taking a very clinical outlook towards people and life.
And tell me about the murder victim and why Dr. Jennifer White is somehow implicated.
Well, they're best friends. They've known each other for decades. They've been neighbors on the same Chicago block.
Her name is Amanda.
Her name is Amanda. Amanda is a school teacher, but again, a very strong woman, also unconventional in her thinking. And what I found the most interesting as I wrote the book was crafting a relationship between two very strong, unconventional women. that had its ups and downs. It's a complex relationship, and there was an adversarial part of it as well as a lot of affection.
So Amanda is found murdered.
That's correct. With four of her fingers surgically amputated.
And is that the primary reason that Dr. Jennifer White is implicated?
There's other circumstantial evidence. There's the fact that they'd had a fight, a very loud argument, Amanda and Jennifer, the previous day. There's the fact that Jennifer is not capable of providing an alibi for herself, and no one was able to give her one. And then, of course, there's the fact that she's a surgeon, and the way the fingers were amputated showed a great deal of skill.
Jennifer is 64 years old, as the novel begins. She's been forced to retire, and that is because the Alzheimer's is becoming more and more apparent.
That's correct, yes.
She has an aide, Magdalena, living with her. Would you read just that that one portion where she is at her Alzheimer's group, starting in the middle of page 26?
Certainly. At our Alzheimer's support group today, we talk about what we hate. Hate is a powerful emotion, our young leader says. Ask a dementia patient who she loves, and she sometimes draws a blank. Ask her who she hates, and the memories come flooding in. Hatred. Hate. The word resonates. My stomach contracts, and bile rises in my throat. I hate. I find my hands clenched into fists. Faces turn to look at me, some men, but mostly women, a variety of races, of creeds, a united nation of the despised, of the despicable. I cannot make out their features exactly. An anonymous mob. It's becoming hard to breathe. What is that noise? It is me. Who are you staring at? Our leader comes over. Our leader is leaving the room. He returns with a youngish woman, bleached blonde hair, too much makeup. She comes straight over to me. Dr. White, the woman says, Jennifer, we're going home now. Shh, no, no yelling. No, please stop. Stop. You're hurting me. No, don't call. I can handle this. Jennifer, come now. That's right. We're going home. Shh, it's okay. It's okay. It's me. Look at me. At me. Magdalena. That's right. We're going home.
Tough scene. Yeah. Tough scene. The book is titled Turn of Mind. Alice LaPlante is with me. Do join us. 800-433-8850. How much of Jennifer is there for us?
Interesting question. She comes and goes. She has moments of acute awareness, and then it goes away. She remembers different things at different times. Things come in and out of focus. You know who she is by the end of the book, I feel. Unfortunately, Alzheimer's as a disease causes a lot of personality changes. It's not just kind of a benign forgetting of your keys. There's a lot of anger and aggression, as I tried to show in that scene that comes out. I'm not sure if they know even if the anger and aggression that they see in so many of these patients is the fact that the social filter is going away, or whether it's the disease that's causing the agitation. So, in other words, is the anger and the rage Jennifer speaking, just unedited, or is it the disease forcing her into a place that she wouldn't really go?
What's fascinating to me is how you have interwoven the conversations that Jennifer has. Sometimes she recognizes people who are very close to her, for example, her daughter. Sometimes she doesn't, for example, her son Mark. Sometimes she looks around, she recognizes nothing, where she is, who she is. And sometimes, as you say, she is acutely aware. And for Magdalena, whom Jennifer describes as needing a job, as being rather destitute otherwise, she's rather disdainful in the sense that she sees her as someone she doesn't care about, and yet Magdalena has to care about her.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. I hadn't thought about it. But yeah, the role of a caregiver, I can't imagine anything harder. It's not just the physical strain, the emotional strain. And like you said, in some cases, taking abuse and yet having to respond with care and affection and love.
Have you experienced that firsthand?
I'd rather not go there. I want to protect the privacy of my family.
I understand. Alice LaPlante, her new novel, with an individual who has Alzheimer's, is titled Turn of Mind. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, novelist Alice LaPlante has written a book. It's a novel with a central character who suffers from Alzheimer's disease. She at times knows who she is, where she is, knows everything that's going on around her, and at other times is totally confused. The book is titled Turn of Mind. Alice, would you read for us again? There's an extraordinarily moving scene here.
Certainly.
Set this up for us.
Jennifer is still at this point living at home. But she's, as many Alzheimer's sufferers are, she's a wanderer, an escapee. She takes off when she can, when Magdalena's not watching her. And that's what she's just done. And I should explain that the way the book is structured, it's in little vignettes that are separated by white space. So there's no chapters. You just come in and out of vignettes in Jennifer's mind. So we've just... there's been no build-up to this. All of a sudden, we just find ourselves in this particular place. I'm in the middle of a street. Dirty snow has been pushed to either side, but it's still treacherous going. I have to tread carefully. There's shouting, cars everywhere, horns blaring. Someone grabs my arm, not gently, pulls me faster than my legs want to move, practically hoists me up a curb onto a cement island. I'm suddenly surrounded by people, strangers. From afar, a voice calls, a familiar one, and the strangers part like the waters of the Red Sea. Here she comes, bright auburn hair, shivering in a short-sleeve T-shirt that exposes her rattlesnake tattoo. Wait, I'm her daughter. Please don't call the police. She arrives, breathless. Thank you, thank you. Whoever got her out of the street, thank you. She takes a deep breath. I apologize for the trouble. My mother has dementia. She's forcing out the words, and her thin frame is starting to shiver. It is bitterly cold. As the crowd begins to disperse, she turns to me. Mom, please don't do that. You scared us all. Where am I? About 2 blocks from home, in the middle of one of the busiest intersections in the city. She pauses. It was my fault. I was putting my bag up in my old bedroom. You know, I'm spending the night again. Magdalena thought it would be best for you. We got to talking, didn't notice you'd wandered off. Where were you going? To Amanda's. It's Friday, isn't it? No, actually it's Wednesday, but I understand. You were trying to find Amanda's house? It's our day. Yes, I understand. She thinks for a minute, seems to make up her mind. I think we should go to Amanda's, see if she's in. And what's your name? I'm Fiona, your daughter. Yes, yes, that's right, I remember now. Let's go, let's see if we can find Amanda. Look, the light is green now. She's holding my arm and urging me forward with purpose. Although I'm at least 3 inches taller than she is, I have trouble keeping up with her stride. We move past the thrift store, past the L station, around the corner of the church, and suddenly the world tilts into place again. I pause at one house, a brownstone with a short black iron fence around its yard. A tree stripped of leaves leans over the path to the front steps. Yes, this is our house, Mom, but we're going to visit Amanda. I remember, I say, 3 houses down. 1, 2, 3. That's right. Here you go. Let's knock on the door and see if Amanda's here. If she's not, we'll go home and have a cup of tea and do the crossword puzzle. I brought a new book. Fiona knocks loudly 3 times, and I press on the doorbell. We wait on the porch, but nobody comes. No face appears behind the curtains of the living room windows. Not that Amanda would ever peer like that. Despite Peter's admonition, she always flings open the door without looking, always ready to face whatever life brings her. Fiona now has her back to the door. Her eyes are closed. Her body is shaking. Whether it's from the cold or something else, I can't tell. Let's go, Mom, she says. Clearly no one's at home. Strange, I said. Amanda has never missed one of our Fridays. Mom, please. Her voice is urgent. She pulls me down the steps so fast I stumble and nearly fall and pushes me back down the sidewalk. 1, 2, 3. We are back in front of the brownstone. Her hand on the gate, she pauses and looks up. Her face is full of pain, but as she gazes at the house, the pain dissipates into something else. Longing.
Alice LaPlante reading from her new novel, Turn of Mind. What is Jennifer thinking? Is she thinking with the ability she still has to think that her friend Amanda is still alive?
She is. She forgets. She doesn't. Throughout the book, she has moments of understanding that Amanda's dead. But mostly she thinks she's still alive. And what Fiona's doing at that point is making a decision that caregivers have to make all the time, which is, do you tell the truth? Do you shine them on? Here, let's go to her house. Let's knock on the door. Well, she's not there. She's dead. But Fiona does that to calm her mother down. And it's a very common scenario.
It's a very interesting scenario that you've created about a woman who begins to wonder whether, in fact, she is a murderess.
That's correct. At the heart of the book is it's a character study of Jennifer, and I think she thinks of herself as having a dark core. And when she realizes a murder has been done to Amanda has been murdered, she can't help but associate that darkness with the possibility she might have been responsible.
Did you write this novel for yourself or for your family?
Oh, for myself, in the sense that I needed to write it.
Do you worry for yourself that, considering the heritage within your family, that this could be something that happens to you as well?
I wouldn't call it worry. And this is something that writing the book has changed in my mind. I've always said to my family, my immediate family, I've got 20 years left. And they say, no, no, no. But that's how I'm living my life. And as you know, there's diagnostics to test for genes. If you have certain genes, you might get Alzheimer's. It's not a very good predictor. It's not very reliable. But there's a new test that was developed this year that involves doing taking some spinal fluid that has an extraordinarily high reliability rate decades in advance of any symptoms. So it's now possible, as I understand it, I'm not a scientist, that someone like me in their 50s could go have this test and know that they are going to have Alzheimer's in their 70s. And of course, when the news of this broke, everyone said, who would do that? There's no cure. How could you live with that? And I kind of fell into that camp. And since I wrote the book, I've changed my mind. If the healthcare and insurance industries weren't what they were, I would get that test. I want to know. I want to know for myself, and I want to protect my family. It's a horrible disease, and it's not just for the individual suffering, but for everyone around her, and I want to spare my family as much of that as I can.
Tell me about your family.
Again, I promised them that I would that the book was not about our mother and that I wouldn't violate our family's privacy. So I want to start with that. But we're a large Irish Catholic family. There's 8 kids. I'm 6 girls, 2 boys. I'm number 2. And except for I ended up in California, and one of my brothers ended up actually here in D.C. Everyone else just stayed in Chicago, stayed very close to home. So they're all there.
The toll on family in your novel, Turn of Mind, is very serious. But you have a division between Fiona, the daughter, Mark, the son. Talk about that division.
They've never really gotten along because they're such different people. Fiona is just a dynamo, very intelligent, highly ambitious. She's already a full professor of finance at the age of 24. Mark, her younger brother, is her older brother is an attorney like his father, and does okay, but he's rather weak in spirit, and has some other problems. And
so what kind of a job does Fiona hold down?
She's an academic. She's a professor in economics at the University of Chicago. And like I said, Mark's a lawyer. And they just don't see eye to eye on anything. And then the stress of the disease has just increased their conflict.
There is also money involved.
There is money involved. There's a great deal of money involved. Money that Jennifer doesn't know where it came from herself. She gets these bank statements and they puzzle her. Fiona, who took over financial power of attorney, about a year prior to the book opening, has full power to write checks, to move money around, and she's in fact very, very good with money.
But Mark wants power of attorney.
And Mark would like the power of attorney because he would like the money. It's so there's that thread in the book as well.
There's more than $2 million involved, at least.
Yes.
There are doctor's bills, lawyer's bills, $50,000 moved to pay for an attorney for which Jennifer is not even aware.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of financial finagling going on, and it's a little fuzzy what the situation really is. Jennifer trusts Fiona.
Does she trust Mark?
And she does not trust Mark.
Alice LaPlante, her book is titled Turn of Mind, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Marathon, Florida. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I am a nursing home nurse, and I've seen, of course, an awful lot of patients going through Alzheimer's. I've also taken care of some in home health. And one of the things that you were talking about was the aggression that we see. And my working theory is this, that at a certain point, they don't know where they are. They don't know who the people around them are. They don't know what you're trying to get them to do, because I often see this come out when we're trying to give them a bath, change their diapers, try to take them to an activity or whatever. And in a sense, if you're completely surrounded by strangers in a place you don't know and they're trying to get you to do something you don't understand, the aggression is a little bit more understandable, that they're lashing out against the circumstance they find themselves in. They're lashing out against the unknown and the scary features that are going on. And I don't know what the actual neurological explanation is, but that's my working hypothesis.
Interesting.
I think that's a very astute observation. One of the things I tried to write into the part of Jennifer as I put myself in her mind was just try to understand how terrifying it must be. And you're absolutely right. You know, quite an understandable reaction to that terror would be aggression.
Putting yourself into Jennifer's mind is had to have been a difficult task.
A lot of people say that. My closest friends say, "How did you do this? It must have been so difficult." And it wasn't. It was very cathartic to do it. It was exciting. I enjoyed the process because I just sunk into that mindset and I was learning so much.
Learning about yourself, learning about others.
Yeah, I think both. You know, there's the famous Flaubert quote, Madame Bovary, c'est moi, Madame Bovary is me. Well, you know, every time a writer creates a character, they're exploring their own internal psyche in some degree. And so there was that part of it. And then there was the part, of course, of having wondered for nearly a decade what my mother might be feeling. Mm.
To Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Diane. This is killing me because it's part of my own memory. Irish Catholic, Italian family. I was caregiver to both my parents that had dementia. And one January day, I was, I think, emptying the trash or something. We had two locks on our door, one with a key that I had, and I must have not locked the door immediately after emptying the trash. And my father, who was a survivor of the Chosin Reservoir, the Chosin Pew in Korea, in his bare feet, walked out, went down 16 floors, and was walking around the complex in his bare feet in you know, middle of winter. And it's
must be
working security.
Yeah,
found him, and he came back but he was hurt on his feet.
Ah.
Because of the cold and inadequate and terrible.
Yeah.
But there are good things that are going on in research, and you know, there should be more funding. And we did get that into a dementia longitudinal study at Johns Hopkins.
I'm glad for that, Paul. And I'm sure listening to this brings lots of feelings to the fore for a great many people. That's what good novels do. And we'll take a short break here from Alice LaPlante's novel, Turn of Mind.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy and his influence on the Tea Party freshmen with journalist Robert Draper. In Draper's recent New York Times Magazine article, he wrote, "McCarthy recruited many of them and anointed them young guns." Draper has been covering the debt ceiling debate for his forthcoming book about the House. Join us.
Welcome back. Alice LaPlante is with me. We're talking about her brand new novel. It's titled Turn of Mind, and the individual at the center of the book, who is doing most of the talking, has Alzheimer's disease. Alice LaPlante's own mother has Alzheimer's, and she, Alice, is quick to point out that this is in no way a biography of her mother. In fact, not only her mother, but her grandmother, her aunt, all have had Alzheimer's, and Alice is currently considering, and perhaps has already decided, to have a test whereby she can learn whether several decades down the road she may be headed for the same thing. I'm going to go back to the phones to Linda in Wellston, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you. This touches me very deeply because my mother is one of eight children and at least five of them, of her siblings, including Mama herself, have had some form of dementia. Four of them we have had diagnosed as Alzheimer's. And it's with that kind of numbers, I said four or five plus Mama, with Mama, with those kinds of numbers, we are, all the cousins have to be looking with terror every time we can't think of the right word or wonder if we've remembered something correctly. And yet, I've never heard of any type of discussion among the family members about who, does anyone know if Grandpa was diagnosed properly? Does anyone know if this happened? Was there, has anyone looked into research or diagnostics?
Well, and of course, the problem up until now has been that there has not been an accurate diagnosis until a postmortem has been done.
That's correct. It's that's why you hear it call, you hear people have dementia. That's kind of the big overall umbrella diagnosis. And to get an actual diagnosis of Alzheimer's, it involves a list of a checklist of things have to be in place, and I can't think of them all. Diane is absolutely right. The only definitive diagnosis can come after death with a brain.
But now
there's apparently this test. Yeah, but you know, you said something that was that I really relate to, and it's, you know, obviously the fear every time you forget your cat's name. Is it happening to me? But also, and this has come up time and time again in our discussions as I tour the country, people who have it in the family talk about the lack of a social infrastructure for dealing with this disease. We're only beginning to come into terms with it. And it's, the numbers are very, very frightening about what's ahead. But in terms of having doctors who can do the diagnosis efficiently and effectively, places who can treat our loved ones, and all the way to the financial implications, which are enormous.
Indeed. Thanks for calling, Linda. And to Glen Burnie, Maryland. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Diane. A wonderful show, as always.
Thank you.
I wanted to call because, your guest was talking about tests. And 3 years ago, my father died. And he didn't die from Alzheimer's, per se. I mean, he was 97 years old. God bless him. But, you know, he wasn't the man that, you know, he was. And I want to see, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Fatui. I'm talking about Dr. Majid Fatui. He's in Baltimore. He's a noted neurologist. And I went to see him because I wanted to know. And he had me go through two sets of tests, one gross neurological, you know, where you close your eyes, touch your nose, walk on your toes, walk on your heels, that
sure,
kind of thing.
Sure.
And another one where you are given a bunch of words to remember, and then like a half hour later, they ask you to repeat them.
Right.
And I scored 30 out of 30, and he said, I can guarantee that you're not going to get Alzheimer's. But he said, but I cannot guarantee that you won't get demented unless you take care of yourself, eat properly, exercise, and that kind of thing. And he also published a book with Will Shortz, the editor of the New York Times crossword puzzle, which he considers to be the gymnasium for the mind doing crossword puzzles.
Yeah, I think a lot of people talk about crossword puzzles, other kinds of challenging exercises for the mind to try to help keep it in shape. Do you do a lot of those, Alice?
No,
you
don't.
You don't.
I should, but I don't. I read a lot.
You read a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of keeping the mind informed. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane. I love your show.
Thanks.
It's the best on the radio. But my question has to do with gender roles and caretaking of the parents who are ill. I have several friends and family who have Alzheimer's or other extremely debilitative diseases. And I'm wondering, it sounds like Mark is the bad character and Fiona is the good character, but I don't like to simplify it that much, especially in a situation like this. In your own personal experience and in the experiences of other people that you've seen, have you noticed a difference in who winds up carrying the boys, the men, or the daughters?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't feel qualified to answer that. I know in my own family, my father is the hero. he's amazing. But I think a lot of times, especially because women live older, they fall into the caregiving roles. But I don't have any statistics for you.
I think that more often it does become the female of the family who takes on that role. But as you say, you consider your father a hero. Sounds to me as though he's taken awfully good care of your mom. There is yet another spot in the book that you might want to read. It starts in the middle of page 9.
I should say that one of the things that I deliberately put some humor in the book, and that surprises people, but it's the sort of situation where you have to laugh because the alternative is too grim. So this is what I would consider a little lighter, at least part of it. I belong to an Alzheimer's support group. This is Jennifer speaking, of course. People come and they go. This morning, Magdalena says it's an okay day. We can try to attend. The group meets in a Methodist church on Clark, squat and gray, with clapboard walls and garish primary colored stained glass windows. We gather in the fellowship lounge, a large room with windows that don't open and speckled linoleum floors bearing the scuff marks of the metal folding chairs. We're a motley crew, perhaps there's half a dozen of us, our minds in varying states of undress. Magdalena waits outside the door of the room with the other caregivers. They line up on benches in the dark hallway, knitting and speaking softly amongst themselves, but attentive, prepared to leap up and take their charges away at the first hint of trouble. Our leader is a young man with a social work degree. He has a kind and ineffectual face, and he likes to start with introductions and a joke. My name is I Forget, and I am an I don't know what. He refers to what we do as the two circular steps. Step one is admitting you have a problem. Step two is forgetting you have a problem. It gets a laugh every time from some because they remember the joke from the last meeting, but from most because it's new to them, no matter how many times they've heard it. Today's a good day for me. I remember it. I would even add a third step. Step three is remembering that you forget. Step three is the hardest of all. Today we discuss attitude. This is what the leader calls it. You've all received this extraordinarily distressing diagnosis, he says, and you're all intelligent, educated people. You know you are running out of time. So what you do with it is up to you. Be positive. Having Alzheimer's can be like going to a party where you just don't happen to know anyone. Think of it. Every meal can be the best meal of your life. Every movie, the most enthralling you've ever seen. Have a sense of humor, he says. You're a visitor from another planet, and you're observing the local customs. But what about the rest of us, for whom the walls are closing in, whom change has always terrified? At 13, I stopped eating for a week because my mother bought new sheets for my bed. For us, life is now terribly dangerous. Hazards lie around every corner. So you nod to all the strangers who force themselves upon you. You laugh when others laugh, look serious when they do. And when people ask, do you remember? You nod some more. Or you frown at first and then let your face light up in recognition. All this is necessary for survival. I'm a visitor from another planet, and the natives are not friendly.
Alice LaPlante, reading from her novel, Turn of Mind. Is there in Jennifer a sense of shame?
Oh, deep shame. Deep, deep shame. I'm not sure where the root is in her character, but when she comes and goes and comes to herself after an episode and understands what has happened, or she's just so mortified. She has so much personal dignity that it's that's very traumatic for her.
She feels as though sometimes she's being treated like a dog.
Yes, and again, that kind of goes with the territories of someone who comes in and out of a competent state. Is if you're treating them like they don't know where they are and they don't know what to do and they don't know how to eat, and then they snap out of it, they're going to be insulted. It's a very volatile relationship between caregivers and patients.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. On that very subject, let's take a call from Severna Park, Maryland. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Mentioning volatility, I am a caregiver, and what with patients that have Alzheimer's and dementia, and there's so much turnover in that field because of the degree of aggression, of flat-out violence perpetrated upon the caregivers. And we do our very best to be as understanding with the individuals. But in this state in particular, caregivers are not allowed to have a self-defense. They're not allowed to defend themselves, even when the patient is hitting them and harming them and hurting them substantially. And as a individual that experienced that recently, I didn't know if you have included that information or references to that in your book, or what your comment would be about that.
Oh, boy. You know, I had no idea about the legal aspect of it. It just never occurred to me. But that's incredible. That makes it even a more difficult role. I have so much respect for caregivers like yourself.
Diane, when you say that you're not permitted even to defend yourself, I have a hard time understanding that.
So did I, and so did the Maryland State attorney that recently handled my case, but that is how it is here in Maryland with the Maryland Department of Aging and the various departments that fall under that health care banner for them. You must take the abuse. You are not allowed to push the patient, strike the patient, move the patient out of your way in any sort of manner, and you're not able to always control that. It is totally up to the employer, and they will fire you. And if you have a contract with the state for Medicaid patients, for example, I was terminated for that very reason. Many
How common
employer,
is the aggression?
Unfortunately, this is what
happens
to me.
In patients with dementia.
I'm not a neurologist, and it doesn't happen to everyone, but it's a common enough factor. There's even a term for it because so many of them, it happens in the late afternoon, early evening. It's called sundowning, and it's just a phenomenon that's been noticed, that they get very agitated. And I absolutely believe that there can be physical violence and injury to caregivers.
You know, I think we must mention that you published your first novel here in your 50s. You've taught writing for 21 years, and you've written books on writing. What about the rules that you set down for others that you had to follow yourself?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let's not call them rules. Let's call them conventions and techniques. But it was work. Let's just take the example of an unreliable narrator, telling a story from the point of view of someone who can't be trusted. The reader can't trust him or her. Is a time honored technique, and it is a technique, and there's a lot of craft based tools that we have as writers to make it possible to do that? And I'll just give you one example because
well,
I know...
Well, someone has wondered whether you were influenced by Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury on that very point.
Benji in The Sound and the Fury. I learned from Faulkner about his mastery of getting a story told.
And you told this story well, Alice. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Alice LaPlante, the book is titled Turn of Mind. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.